So I borrowed a lot for this from Rabbi Lerner from the Youngsville Jamaica States. It was his Shabbos HaGadol Drasha, which is fascinating because I have more access to Shabbos HaGadol Drashos this year than ever before, since they're not given on Shabbos. So he asked the question about why we... Well, space limitations, people don't want to go to shul, all those things. But I actually thought it worked out really well because I would never have heard this otherwise, and I thought it was excellent. So I want to share with you his take on spilling wine. It's one of the weirdest customs that we have. Well, I don't know about that. We have a lot of weird customs. But it is among the weirder things that happen at the Seder that all of a sudden we start tipping our fingers into our cup, and at a certain amount of times along the way, what in the world are we doing? What is the purpose? What is the point? So that's what I want to try to do tonight. And as you can see from the Makoros, we have definitely quite a array of sources to do, especially the picture one on the top right corner. So let's start with what it probably says in most Haggadahs. If you have one here, you could check to see what yours says. But it says something to the effect, especially if it's a Hebrew Haggadah, Noahim Latif Matmin Akos. This is Dafka writers, their language. It is customary to get rid of a little bit of your cup. Be'et Amira Dam Va'esh, when you say the words Dam Va'esh, V'gamba Mira Dam Tzardeya, and similarly we do the same thing by the Makos, V'gamba Mira Tetzachadash, and similarly by Tetzachadash Bechav. Okay, so that's what we do. And then, of course, we have Dam Eish with Timrod Ashan, etc., etc., and that goes through Dam Tzardeya Kinim Arov, Devershchin Bard Ar Bechoshech, Maka Bechorot, and then Rabbi Yehuda Yanotem Em Simanim Tetzachadash Bechav. So if you were keeping count, you have dipped your finger how many times? 16 times, right? So the question is, there should be two questions on this. The first question is,
what's the significance of
16? Okay, so that's the third question, but it's definitely we're actually going to get to that at some point. But yeah, why 16? What else?
Why at all?
Yeah, why do we do this? Right? Like, I understand that, like, there's a lot of weird things going on, but, like, what's the purpose of it? We don't normally stick our fingers in our cups at any given meal. So why are we doing this? Okay. And then the other question I think is how, right? I used to get into fights with my third grade students. Shows you how mature I am. But anyway, because they all told me, they're like, use your pinky. And I was like, I don't know. I think it's actually this finger. And we went back and forth. And I think that there's sources for everything. In fact, there are some people that use, as you can see from the picture, there are some people that actually use a spoon.
Very sanitary.
Does anybody?
A drop of wine is spilled from the cup.
Which Haggadah do you have? The Koren Haggadah. Okay.
Some spill.
Okay, we've got the Vayagid Moshe. Right, we've got the Goldberg.
Yeah.
Love the Goldberg. You can't get.
I have a Maxwell
House. My Haggadah of choice, in case you care, is I use the Art Scroll Family Haggadah, which has nothing in it. It has not a single Dvar Torah. I like it because every year I put post-its all over it, and I change color post-its from year to year. So it's just all the stuff that I've decided to add to my Seder, but I don't have to worry about covering up any other person's stuff. All right, so you have the children's Haggadah, and what's that? Sam, it's so funny. I actually today saw that there was a Haggadah by Rabbi Riskin for the very first time. I couldn't believe I had no idea. But it looks like it's been around for a long time. But so isn't it amazing? We all brought different Haggadahs. I brought two. I brought this one, the Haggadah Brura, just because it has all the halachic footnotes of the Mishnah Brura. And I brought the Abar Benel's Haggadah, which we'll get back to in a little bit. But yeah, basically it says the same thing by everybody. Right? What do? You spill out.
You remove.
You remove, right? Okay, so that's like the PC way of saying it. Like, is it your finger? Is it your pinky? Is it your spoon? Are you pouring off?
Yeah.
All right, so that's like the general gist of it. So the Scholar's Haggadah. Anybody ever use that? I opened it once. It was like way too much for me. So the scholar Zagada is Dr. Guggenheimer. I love a shalom. He actually just passed away. He wrote a lot of scholarly stuff. Like, it's like reading his Divrei Torah. You were like, well, I need a dictionary. But anyway, so in the scholar Zagada, so I only added this in because he did pass away in the last couple of weeks. So I felt like it was a zchus for his neshama that will, you know, bring it, you know, in a little bit. So he actually does not bring a reason at all. But he does mention in there that it's a heavily Ashkenazic custom. And then he says that the Oriental tradition might be a little bit different. By Oriental, I know like that doesn't sound so PC, but by Oriental, he's talking about like the Middle Eastern. So like the Sephardic custom might be a little bit different. And again, put that on the back burner because we're going to have to go back to that at some point tonight. Okay, so we have three questions. Why is it that we dip the wine or take the wine out? How do we go about that? And why 16 times? Which doesn't have to be 16 times. There's somebody doing 13 times. Actually, this is like brilliant. There are people that sell napkins. It's the Makos napkin. It's a full circle that has a fingerprint spot for each maka. Labeled. So this way you're like, Dom, you won't miss any, right? So anyway, it's great.
If you don't fill in the whole circle, does it count?
Yeah, it depends. If you're in Florida, for sure not. But yeah, I think that like, to me, the takeaway from that napkin was that if someone will buy it, someone will make it. But okay, so those are our three questions. Why do we do this? How do we do this? And why 16 times? So before we attempt to answer the question, I'm going to put it out there to everybody. Why do we spill off, remove whatever you want, the wine from the cup? So children should ask. Actually, the Vilna Gaon says something along those lines. It's a good answer.
We suffer during these naklos. The Jews suffer during each of these naklos. They were an atonement for the Jews as well. So here we are celebrating Geula or whichever coast we're up to. We have to diminish it a little bit because we were afflicted by this. Well, those are some of the highlights of Sanda Makos. Yeah.
Sroli is going to take the controversial approach of the Ibn Ezra that says that the first bunch of Makos happened to the Jewish people also.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's fine. Anybody else? There's like a...
And they said by Choshech. They were burying the dead that were punished, so okay. It was not just the first couple.
Then there's, you know, Sroli also mentioned it, but we're celebrating at the suffrage of other people also, so therefore we reduce our joy.
Right. Okay. So that is the famous answer, and if you take a look at source. Is the picture labeled? I can't tell if that was like I did that afterwards with my pen or not. Does it say on top of the picture, Koran Graphic Haggadah? Yes. All right, fine. So then that stuff is there. Okay, great. So it did get, one of them got cut off, but I'll come back to it later. The Koran Graphic Haggadah, yes, there is one. It's a graphic novel. Says it's two people, but I only picked her because she gives the answer. The wine is a symbol of our joy, and the droplets symbolize the tears we shed over bloodshed, even that of our enemies. Right, and that's probably the Devar Torah that's most famous, that comes from our children, right? Our children bring home that Dvar Torah. The question is, where does the Koran Graphic Haggadah get that from? Right, like where did this minhag start? Right, at the first Seder in Egypt, right? Did they do that? I guess it would have been really hard because they could have only done 9 of the 10 makos, right? At Chatzos, they had to be well past this part of the Haggadah, right? So, clearly, it didn't happen at the first Seder. Did it happen in Tanakh? Did it start in the Gemara, the Mishnah? Like, where did this custom start from? All right, so we got to figure that one out. So let's move across to Rabbi Sacks. So he's going to give us his own take on it. Our custom is to spill a drop of wine at the words blood, fire, and pillars of smoke, right? Dam va'esh v'timrot ashan, at the mention of each of the plagues, and then the three words of Yehuda's mnemonic. Many explanations have been offered. interestingly, I spent a lot of time trying to find out what the many explanations are. Did not have so much success. But the most beautiful is that of Abu Draham, who interprets it in accordance with the verse in Proverbs, right? Mishlei, b'nefolei v'achal tismach. Do not rejoice when your enemy falls. Even as we give thanks for the miracle of the plagues, as a result of which our ancestors gained their freedom, we also shed a symbolic tear for those who suffered. According to some commentators, that is why we do not mention the word simcha in connection with Pesach, unlike the other festivals. Right? It's not zman simchatenu. A Talmudic passage states that when the waters of the sea returned and trapped the pursuing Egyptian army, the angels wished to sing a song of praise. God silenced them with the words, "My creatures are drowning in the sea, and you wish to sing a song." God does not rejoice in the downfall of the wicked. So according to Rabbi Sacks, who's quoting from who? Who's his source for this? Abu Draham, which is important, right? It is... He is Sephardic. Yeah, that is true. That's one of the problems. We're going to have an even bigger problem on that in just a little bit. But we're sympathetic for our enemies.
Why?
As opposed...
You're shedding a symbolic tear, right? You have the salt water there still, no?
Right, but how are you going to remove it? Meaning, like, here what we're saying is I have my full cup of wine, right? That's I think, the vart we tell the kids. You have a full cup of wine, but you can't have a full cup of wine because...
You just realized tears 20 minutes ago with the salt water.
Right, but how... You have this big jar of salt water, right? Which we have more than enough. Right? Nobody ever uses the entire jar of salt water. So, like, what...
It's not valuable. Unless you buy it for $2.59.
That's true.
The store, but
it,
what?
It's not diminishing the joy if you take out of salt water.
Right. Yeah, that's a better answer.
Right.
So we're diminishing our joy by taking out from the cup of wine. Interestingly, halachically...
Is it a sacrifice?
Everything you do is a sacrifice.
Yeah.
Can I just say this? As much as this is an introduction,
it pains him,
to the Makos, these words are from Yoel. This is not referring to this.
You said Dam Ve'esh V'Timro Rashan.
Yeah, how is that the play? I wrote an article on this last
year. Does that reference them?
And this is referring to a future Gula. This has nothing to do with the train. So.
Right.
To say we're spilling wine for...
No.
Well, that's why we have 16, right? Meaning... Right, the question is, do you need Dam Ve'esh V'Timrod Ashan in order to get to 16? Because 16 we'll see has significance, which is the Ari's question, right? I don't know. But yeah, it's a lot of the things that we quote are like a little bit out of context.
Right.
No, but these sound like things from Egypt. Dam, right? There was the Maka blood, Aish, right? The country was destroyed. There was definitely that, and Timrod Ashan, the smoke of destruction.
That was the very not good connections to.
No, I'm saying like if you look, in one of the other Haggadahs that have pictures, right? Like they show you. I love it. It's like the best one. It's the 10 plagues. And they start off like what like the cumulative impact of each maka is. And like just because the maka goes away doesn't mean that there's not like residual effect. So like by the time you hit number 10, like Egypt does have like it's burning. Like it's just in complete shambles. You have the fire from Barad, you have other things, like it's just destroyed. But yeah, I hear that it's a fair point, that it's not really Tzach Hadash Bechav, at least I can understand how it's connected. I have a harder time with the first three. So yeah, that's a good point. So what's the emotion that's going on according to Rabbi Sacks?
And by the way, we refill the coast before you
drink it. We do, right? We're gonna get that also. So it's temporary, right? Well, because we're in like it's a conflict, it's a halachic conflict. Right. On the one hand, we have this principle that we have to get rid of wine for whatever reason. So according to the Abu Draham, according to Rabbi Sacks, it's been holy v'chal tismach. Fine. Okay. According to, at the end of the day, we need a full cup. So we refill. So yeah, it kind of like is a little bit weird. But the emotion that we have here is sympathy. We're sad. That's what, according to Rabbi Sacks, the whole purpose is to feel sad.
Well, that's why we don't say a whole halakha for the next 6 days.
Right? Correct. Yeah, yeah. So the question is, we're sympathetic for our enemies? Like, how does that work? Right? Like, could you imagine if, like, after the Holocaust, someone had suggested that, like, I don't know, at one of our celebrations, we take a little bit of our joy out because, look, at the end of the Holocaust, Nazis died. Right? Like, we would not be able to wrap our head around it. Now, the truth is, we look at it differently because this is 3,500 years later or so. So, like, the Egyptian thing is such a long time ago. I'm sure in 100 years from now, there will be a generation that won't look at the Holocaust and the survivors with the same reverence that we do. I think time does that. But how does that work? So Rabbi Sacks, in one of his other works, explains that there were innocent Egyptians also, right? And they suffered from the Makos. So that's where this comes from. And by doing that, what he does is he gets away from the obvious question of how could we, like...
Wait, now there are innocent Egyptians?
Yeah, like meaning like there were people that were enslaved in Egypt that were Egyptians and they were in the same boat as the Jews. So that's how he gets around it. You don't have to like it, but that's how he gets around it.
This is like violating some principles that we have. All the citizens of a town that does bad things, they're all guilty of whatever crime it was. So that would fall on these quote-unquote innocent Egyptians, would it not?
So that's the question. The question is, are they, you know, Hitler's willing executioners? It's one possibility. Or are there innocent people? It is a tough one. I just listened to someone's story on the Holocaust earlier in the week, and it was like so sad because, you know, she was from Hungary, so thank God, like, she was spared until like 1944. But she said, like, she was convinced we are Hungarian Jews, not Jewish Hungarians, or however you would say it. They considered themselves Hungarians first and then Jews, and they thought the Hungarians would take care of them. And she's like, the first people to line up to get rid of us were the Hungarians. Like, it's a hard one. So then you look and say, like, okay, like, maybe there is no such thing as an innocent person in those situations. But I don't know. Maybe there were some Egyptians that were really just enslaved the same way, but God said, I have to smite all the Egyptians. So this way, like, nobody can say, you know, this wasn't God, but it was a sickness and it only impacted some people. So that's how Rabbi Sacks understands it. Rabbi Eliyahu Kitov, everybody's probably familiar with him from his very famous book, Book of Our Heritage. It's the one that you get for bar mitzvahs,
yeah.
Right? Or give for bar mitzvahs. I actually gave it to a person as a bar mitzvah gift. And then they moved and they were getting rid of stuff and they called me and asked if I wanted any svarim and I got it back. I was like, it's like, wow. It's like, I lent you your bar mitzvah gift for the last like 7 years. So anyway, he quotes the Abar Benel, who says, couldn't have been done, the same idea as Rabbi Sacks, that we feel bad that the Egyptians died, but he spins it in a different way. He says that it could have been done in a better way. If the Jewish people were more worthy, then maybe it didn't have to be that the Egyptians were wiped out that way. Maybe God had a different way of doing it. That is another possibility. So again, it's all in the same spirit, but slightly different twist. Now, Rabbi Riskin, who I did not have it at home to photocopy, but Greg does have it, basically the gist of his is, we're sad. Right, there's the loss of human life, even our enemies. When our enemies die, we feel bad. Interestingly, Rabbi Riskin does not quote anybody in his sources. Where does he get it from? He probably gets it from the Koren graphic Haggadah, right? So the answer is that Rabbi Riskin...
I looked at the year, not a chance.
Say again?
I looked at the year, not a chance.
Right. So the answer is... That and it just struck me that, like, in my Haggadah, my third grade Haggadah, I have this.
What do you mean? He quoted from the Megillah.
Who?
It says in the Gemara Megillah.
states that when the waters of the sea returned, the trapped pursuing, God said, how can you...
No. In Rabbi Riskin's Haggadah, which is not here, he does not... Can I borrow Rabbi Riskin's Haggadah for a second? Thank you. I can't tell you how many Haggadahs I opened up today just to this one page.
So if God's saying, I can't rejoice because my creatures are being created, and we're supposed to be like God-like, so certainly we should feel the similar vein.
Right. Well, okay, so this is what he says. According to Jewish tradition, that's not a source. When each of the plagues is counted, we dip our little finger into the wine. Our little finger, because I would say the pinky. And spill a drop of it and pour some wine out of the cup. This symbolizes our sadness at the loss of human life, even that of our enemies. He does then quote the same medrash that Rabbi Sacks quotes. But Rabbi Sacks, he quotes the Abu Draham as the tradition. There's no tradition. There's no source to Rabbi Riskin's. So who is his source? So the answer is, he probably felt it was one of those Divrei Torah that we don't know who said it. So we say, there's a famous Dvar Torah.
Well, we don't know who wrote the Haggadah, so.
That's a good question. I'm sure we have an idea. I don't, but. Okay, so that, again, he has no Makor. Why does he have no Makor? He has no Makor because it's just a famous Dvar Torah. So the question is, where does it come from? So this is the best one. Rabbi Riskin, not Rabbi Riskin. Rav Sacks quotes the Abu Draham, which Srilly pointed out is a Sephardi custom. The scholar Sagada says that it's not a Sephardic custom. Then Rabbi Kitov quotes the Abar Benel. The Abar Benel is also a Sephardi source. But this is the kicker. Now, this was not necessarily written by the Abar Benel, but this is based on the Abar Benel Haggadah. He has his own Haggadah. Do you know what's missing from this? He doesn't have why we spill. All he says, and this is Art Scroll, similar to all the other ones, as each of the words is said, a bit of wine is removed from the cup with a finger or by pouring. He asks a lot of questions, which is like classic Abar Benel. Do you know what's not there? This question. He doesn't ask why, because he doesn't answer why. Because probably the Abar Benel didn't do that at his Seder. Okay, so that's the Abar Benel. That's why I brought this. You can take that out of it. I don't own the Abu Draham's Haggadah. But guess what's missing from there also?
The Abar Benel.
There's no source there for why we spill the wine out.
Did it have the footnote to spill the wine out?
It's probably not, because it's not an Art Scroll Haggadah. It's like there's some. Rabbi Lerner had like some of his digital sources were like pictures of Haggadahs from the 1400s from like the Geniza and whatever. So I didn't have access to all of them, but it's not in either one of them. And yet they're the source. So that kind of leaves us wondering what in the world is going on. Okay, so now let's turn ourselves sideways.
Can I just, the last part of Rabbi Sacks' paragraph is interesting about Hashem's reaction to the Malachim singing.
Right.
And yet one of the paramount moments is the Yaz Yashir and Miriam's Shira as well. And yet it seems that Hashem is frowning on that.
Well, Hashem is certainly frowning upon the angels doing that. But also, it's like Bashas Maisa, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's a little bit tasteless. Like, they're drowning now. Like, how do we do that? As Yashir is a little bit later.
We can sing along.
Also, they're just watching. Mm-hmm. Jews are just saved. That's like almost spontaneous. Like, you just to be forgiven for not feeling your enemy's pain the moment that you've just been saved.
Okay. That works? All right, there you go. All right, so we're now turning sideways. Mikrai Kodesh is now on top, and the New York Times is facing the wrong way on the bottom. Okay. So here we go. Sefer Mikrai Kodesh. It's a great book. I bought it in Mivaseret for 5 shekel. They like sold it before every holiday. They sold one volume of it. So I own 4 of them. It's actually one of those, like, because I bought a Sefer at the YU Sarm sale for a quarter that I was like super pumped. I was like, if I get one chabura out of it, it's going to be like the best like gig ever. And it's going to be on the giveaway pile for sure. But Malki wanted to give away Mikrai Kodesh, and someone was in her house. She's like, why don't you take those? I was like, no, I want those. So anyway, I want to share with you just a halachic work. And what's really amazing about Sefer Mikrai Kodesh is the footnotes are awesome. Like, the actual, like, tap is like, it gives you the halacha. You could find that just about anywhere. But, like, you can really go to town with his sources. So he says, Noagim latif shalosh pamim mikos hayayin beit shomrim damesh v'tirun ashan. That sounds actually eerily similar to Dafka Rider. They're getting it from the same place. He says, it took me 6 photocopies to even get this. So hine shalosh esrei pamim noagim latif kiv shemaskirim kol achat me'eser makot ukish omrim ditzach adash bechav. In the end, you should get 16 times total. Leminhaga Ashkenazim, I have no idea what that is, but be'etzba l'kli acher. You take it in your finger and you put it into another vessel. That sounds right. Yeah. That could be the makor for why you need the napkin. With the ten fingerprints. So this way it goes. It's better than when you put it on like the tablecloth. Do you have a little cup thing?
We have that exact purpose.
You have a little cup
It's a little glass thing that the coast sits in that you can either pour over or dip in and have it pool in this little cup thing.
Okay.
We're talking about a
Becher
tray?
Yeah.
Oh, so use the Becher tray. You don't have a specially designated.
No, but it's not a Becher tray. It's not silver.
It's not silver. It's right. Yeah, I'm there.
It looks like almost like a glass ashtray, but it's designed. It was like part of a.
Okay, but it's not like you don't have it specifically for that purpose.
No, you don't need it. We use it having that
for that. Does everybody have one?
Everyone has one. Yeah.
So everybody has a.
Has a Becher tray underneath their Becher, yeah.
I grew up that you took your napkin that was next to you and you just went like that. Well, I grew up like that.
Right,
and that was it. But all right, fine. Although I did have a Becher tray growing up, as did all my siblings. But the cost of silver...
For
always. But the cost of silver went up. So when my kids got their Bechers from the same person that I got my Becher from...
Yeah. Didn't come with
they did not get a tray.
You could use glass.
What are those things? All right, so here we go. So in the end, we have 16 all together. The problem is, as David pointed out before, is you now don't have a full cup, so you refill it. All right, Henry, you'll tell us if this is actually what you do, or if it's other Sfardim that have this minhag. They take the water, the wine out, and they put it into a broken vessel. No, do you dip? I'm just curious.
So my father used his index finger, so my mother would have a bowl, and he would...
And she came over with the bowl. I would like never...
Like a splash or like a dip?
A splash.
Yes.
Oh. That's
he would go.
That's a hybrid of the pouring.
Okay.
Yeah.
So your mom, but your mom only came to him. So did you also do that? It was just a Baal HaSeder.
My father led the whole thing.
No mess on the table.
Wait. Okay. So no one else flicked wine.
No.
Only the head.
Which is what I do in my house.
Okay, now I
catch it or no?
My wife comes.
I find all this is fascinating because the real question is, why does anybody do this, right? Okay, so let's take a look at the footnotes, right? I promised that the footnotes were...
You're simulating these tears. That's a little more dramatic, so...
Who? The Sfardim.
Yeah.
Yeah, the irony is that they're... We don't even know where they got it from. Meaning, in all likelihood... at some point, like Ashkenazi Jewry seeped into Sephardic culture and like revealed this. Now, where is this from, by the way? This source, Noagim Latif Shalosh Pamim Mikos HaYayin Be'eich Omrim Dam Ve'eich V'turin Ashan, which we saw in Dafka Writer, which clearly Dafka Writer is not the source from the, for this. What is the source? So take a look at Mem Vav, the Ramah. The Ramah is obviously the commentator on Shulchan Aruch. What he does is he adds in Ashkenazic custom when it is not the same as what Rav Yosef Karo says on behalf of the Sfardim, which means that enters in Rav Moshe Isserles, the Ramah, as what? He's saying that this is a brand new thing, which means that it makes perfect sense that this did not exist in the time of the Abarbanel and Abu Dram on the Sephardic side, right? So that's where it comes from. So the question is, where does Ramah get it from? So the very, very first Makor that we have is the Sefer Rokeach. The Rokeach, I believe, lived in Worms around the time of the Crusades. And this is what he says. I did not have the source, so I wrote it down. Minag Avotenu, he says that this is Minag Avotenu. It sounds a lot like Rabbi Riskin, right? But he doesn't say where it came from. Minag Avotenu. Now, one thing I think is important to note, and this is something that Michael Lavner, my neighbor, has pointed out, is that there is a lot, but after the Gemara, before like the Rishonim, like there is a long void of time, right, where the Gaonim don't have that much stuff written. And because of that, sometimes, and it doesn't mean that stuff wasn't written, it just means stuff didn't necessarily survive. If it didn't make the Gemara, and it doesn't make the cut for, and it does, and you know, it got lost, so something could have existed for a few hundred years, and we wouldn't know. So he says, Minag Avotenu, and he quotes a lot of different people that did this. His father did it, the Shmuel HaNavi, not Shmuel HaNavi from like Tanakh, and he quotes a couple other people, and then he quotes one person, Rabbeinu Klonimus, who we might know from Slichos. He wrote a lot of the Slichos. So he says that it was Minhag Avosenu, Ein Lehit Lo Tzeitz. We should not mock this Minhag. So why would we think about mocking this Minhag? The reason why we might think about mocking this Minhag was there used to be an ancient custom among non-Jews that when they would have one of these meals, they would also pour off wine. And the reason why they did that was they wanted to ward off evil spirits. So all of a sudden, we go from this beautiful minhag about how we think so highly of everybody, and we can't stand the thought that people are suffering, even our enemies, and therefore we won't drink a full cup of wine, to the possibility that this is like a cultish, superstitious minhag. But he says, right, the Rokeach says, Ein lehit lo tzeitz. I don't want you to make fun, because that's not true. So he then says, what's the reason why we do this? So the reason why we do this is because of the number 16. So what is special about the number 16? So besides dipping 16 times here, by Yirmiyahu, it says the word dever 16 times. There are 16 aliyot a week. I did the math. It's actually not. It's 17, but maybe maftir doesn't count. 16 aliyot a week. In the Beis HaMikdash, they brought 16 lambs as regular korbanos. What are 16? So the Rokeach says, Lo yazik lanu. That's what he says. He says, if you do this, we won't get hurt. It sounds like grandma, right? Poo, 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 right? Bli ayin hara, right? If I'm going to do this 16 times, I'm going to take it out, and no dam on me, no eish on me, no timrot asha, no ten makos, no detach, no adash, no be'achav. That's what he sounds like. So what's his emotion?
Fear,
right? He is afraid. So what he says is, how do I get around it? I do this symbolically as a way of davening, right? That's how we get it from being cultish and superstitious. It's a way of davening that what? That I should be spared. So that's another possibility. Now if you take a look at Mem Zayin, so the Rama, when he says that it's 16 times, right? So the Rama, his source is Kasav Rama B'Darche Moshe Kineged Charbo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shenikra, I have no idea. So he says that it's the sword of God has 16 faces. And there is an angel, HaMemuneh Al HaNikama. There's an angel whose purpose, who's out there to do what? He's appointed to prevent us from what? Or to take vengeance. So the Darkei Moshe, which is the Rama, he has a different book, he suggests that the reason for doing this is what? Vengeance. What are we hoping? We're saying the same way that God hit the Egyptians, God is going to hit the all our enemies. Yeah. Okay. So that's his. Okay. So, and then the Gra, which David said at the beginning, was it just something that we do to ask questions? Right. So that's where we're at. So I want to try to pull it all together. But before that, I just want to answer try to understand where Rabbi Sacks and where Rabbi Eliyahu Kitov get their source of the Abu Draham and the Abar Ben El. So if you take a look at the last source, which is really hard to read.
Wait till you're older.
I remember when the Chabura started and it was not hard to read. Okay, so this is the New York Times. I did write it. It's August something, 1930. I think it's August 8th. It's my birthday. Professor. Professor Edward Banneth. I guess this is the obituaries. Professor Edward Banneth died. Who was he? So if you want to look up, you could look up his bio if you Google it. But he was a rabbi in Germany. And he has a whole piece on why we do this. And he says that Hashem is in pain during this whole story. Right? The fact that the Egyptians, God has to destroy his own creations, it hurts God. So what do? We emulate God. We want to be just like him. So we take a couple drops off. Rabbi Banneth, he quotes that he heard this from his father when he was very young. Okay. So when he wrote Divrei Torah, Rabbi Edward Banneth, this is what he wrote as his initials. Resh Aleph Bet. Right? Rabbi Aleph Bet. Who are the two most famous people that we know, Al-Bet, the Abar Ben El, and Abu Draham. So where does Rabbi Sacks, where does Rabbi Kitov come up with it? He is a very unknown source, but his Dvar Torah floated around with the letters Reish Al-Bet. And people assumed that it was someone else. That is where the sources come from, which explains why it didn't make it into the Abar Ben El's Haggadah and it didn't make it into the Abu Draham's Haggadah. And this is like one of those funny, like, historical footnotes, how Rashi Tevos sometimes get you into trouble. I want to leave you with one other possibility. Where did Rabbi Banneth get this from? Right? He says, I heard this from my youth. But nowhere else do we have this idea. The idea that it was out of compassion for our enemies. Right? The initial source is the Rokeach. He talks about a completely different set of emotions. He talks about fear. I don't want
to
get...
God says it to Yonah. Why should I rejoice in the destruction of the city, even if they're evil? Like,
right, right. But I'm saying, the question is, what is the makor? Like, nobody... For the Minhag exists for 800 years. Right? He died in 1930. He was born in the 18-somethings. I think the 1850s. So, in his... until he comes around, nobody says that. It's the source is the Rokeach, who says we do it because we're afraid that we're going to get hit with these makos also. The Darche Moshe then, 400 years later, 300 years later, adds in the idea that there's vengeance. So where does he get it from, right? What's the makor of his? So Rabbi Binyamin Lau, in his book, Divrei Yirmiyahu, which is named for his grandfather, maybe. So he writes this whole book, and at the end, this is what he writes. His introduction to the very last page is, I had an extra page, and I didn't want it to go to waste. So I want to share with you one more thought. Then he puts it in there. He says that we Jewish people are Rachmanim b'nei Rachmanim. That we're merciful people. And because we're merciful, the sons of merciful people, when our enemies suffer, it's just not proper for us to rejoice. And that is probably where Rabbi Edward Banneth gets it from. And that's what seeps into 200 years of Divrei Torah afterwards. So this is where I was. I was like listening to this whole thing and I was like, there's got to be more. So I Googled it and figured like someone's got to have an article. Someone's going to have something to add. And so I found this beautiful article. I forget who wrote it. And he offers the following explanation. He says that each one of the opinions that we quoted, going back to the Rokeach, going to the Darche Moshe the Ramah, and going to the 1800s, Rabbi Lau and Rabbi Banneth and Rabbi Sachs and all these, they're all speaking from the vantage point and the emotion of the time that they lived in. When the Rokeach wrote his Dvar Torah, he was like living through the Crusades. And in the times of the Crusades, he could not even wrap his head around vengeance. How would he put that in writing when the people were running through and he had probably witnessed his own neighbors being killed? But the emotion that was so strong for him was what?
Fear.
Was fear. And so that's what he talks about. He talks about, God, shield me from these makos. The Ramah has the benefit of a few hundred years later. And so when he wrote it in Krakow, he talks about the idea of vengeance for all the things that had happened to the Jewish people. And hoping it would go back on those Gentiles that had done it to them. But what happens a few hundred years later, the 1800s? All of a sudden, the Jews are accepted into society. Right? The Jews are welcomed in. It's the Enlightenment. People wanted the Jews to be part of their country and part of their culture. So all of a sudden, we had to get rid of the idea of vengeance. And we introduced the idea that there's humanity, there's kindness, and all that. But I think what's amazing, and this is what I think Rabbi Lerner said this, is that you have a lot of the most recent stuff where you find the most Haggadahs with his Dvar Torah were people that lived through the Holocaust and right after the Holocaust. And their Divrei Torah, to write this, how could they do that? How could they look at it that way? And he offers the following, which I thought was really beautiful. When the world goes nuts, we strive to be humane. And so, when we look and say, look, cultured people, so to speak, can be so inhumane, that's when we put our own feelings in there and say, we strive. We strive to be humane no matter what. And so that's why on the heels of all that we've gone through, yet we can sit there for the last 200 years and say, no, we, just because our enemies are bad doesn't mean that we wish them bad. God will take care of that, but we do feel a little bit bad at all. So a little bit bad in general. The question is, which voice is correct? Is it the Rokeach? Is it the Ramah? Is it Rabbi Lau?
It could be all
of them. So this article that I found says that it's fine. The whole purpose of the night of Leil HaSeder is that there are many voices. The fact is that the Dalet Banim show up to the Seder, and you could rest assured that each one of them had a very different take on the story. And yet the hope is that they can all be at the table, and that they could all talk to each other, and they could all talk in a respectful tone. And so this person suggested that whichever feeling, whether it's vengeance, fear, humanity, whichever one speaks to you is fine. And whichever one speaks to the person sitting next to you at the Seder, that's fine too. But the goal has to be that when we sit at the Seder, we can all sit and talk civilly to each other. That's our hope. And I would venture a guess that if we could somehow figure out a way to do that, like not only at the Seder, but throughout like the year, we probably would find ourselves in a very different place the following Pesach. Oh, cool.